guidelines came out in 2000, since then, you know, there's considerations that have to be made. For example, in 2005, we've had the, We've had the introduction of and licensure of recommendations for TDAP. Okay, so this is what I'm talking. This is what I'm talking about with regards to the guidelines for the control of pertussis outbreaks. This is the manual that we're referring to. So, again, the considerations that have to be made with updating the guidelines are the new adolescent and adult vaccines, the recent changes in diagnostics, the need for judicious use of antibiotics, and limited and then the limited resources in the local and state health departments with regards to outbreak investigations. I think throughout the conference we've heard different talks about pertussis outbreaks, thinking new ways of with regards to how much it costs per case, especially during an outbreak, how many man hours it takes for case investigation. So for the workshop, we have some rules of engagement. This is not going to be your typical session where we have our panel members give a PowerPoint presentation. We want to hear from you. Audience participation will be rewarded. I have my two lovely chocolate. Well, I have my two friends up here, Tammy Scoff and Stacey Martin, who are both epidemiologists who work on pertussis, who have chocolate. And so any response, discussion, comments will be rewarded with chocolate. We also have the non-chocolate option of Twizzlers. Our panel members who have graciously introduced themselves are here to share their experiences. We've spoken to them prior to this conference, and we know what they've shared their ideas with us, but we want to hear from you. So please, you know, they're here to share their experiences. They're here to facilitate an open dialogue with you. The slides up here are for discussion. They're going to be, you know, they're going to help us focus our discussion. And again, the session is being recorded, so really importantly, we'd like for you to use the microphones. And most importantly, please have fun. So again, these are our panel members. So the topics for today's discussion that we'd like to focus on is, first, the format of the new CDC pertussis outbreak prevention and control guidelines. So to really focus specifically on the format. The second topic we'd like to talk about are the core principles of pertussis outbreak control and prevention. You know, when it comes to these core principles, such as chemoprophylaxis, what is data-driven and what is expert opinion? You know, I think a lot of us know the challenges of in an outbreak or in a case setting when you want to treat close contacts, what determines that? How do we determine that? So I'd like to start off with the current guidelines. So thoughts about the current guidelines, knowing the format, is it helpful? What about regards to the level of detail? Is the background material useful, or is it in the setting of an outbreak or case investigation and prevention and control, is it just too much information to have to go through? In addition, as I mentioned before, is it helpful for you to know what is data-driven versus what is expert opinion? Is it easy to use? What are your likes and your dislikes? And so while you're trying to gather your thoughts and courage to come up to the microphone, I'd like for some of our panel members to share their opinions or their comments with us. I could cold call Kathleen.
What, I have to go first? Well, I've been in my current job for a little over a year, and so I've been working my way through all the vaccine preventable disease guidance documents that the California Department of Public Health has, and so I've really been trying to think about some of these issues. And pertussis, we haven't made any big changes to our guidelines, but I have been swayed, I think, by Oregon's information, and Tila can say more about that, but at any rate, I could just say that thinking of a more targeted approach, which is an approach used by Canada and Australia and perhaps the UK, my first thought was, if we're not prophylaxing everyone as under the current recommendations, is this somehow going to lead to a chain of transmission that ultimately infects an infant who would have serious disease? And obviously that's a concern. And Oregon has some very nice information where they've looked at the literature, and it's a bit unclear how much efficacy post-exposure prophylaxis has in preventing disease. And so that was quite influential to me, and I'll let Tila say more.
We don't really use the CDC guideline. Nothing personal, sorry.
No. Again, feel free to criticize. We're not. There are no hard feelings. We want to hear this. So
we have our own guideline in Oregon, and we're pretty happy with it. Guideline is short and flexible. It's a living document. It doesn't cover every possible situation that you might face out there, but it's flexible and you can tweak it. We pretty much cover the responsibilities of local health department labs in Oregon. We cover basic information on the disease, what's available on laboratory testing in Oregon, what we recommend on sporadic case investigation, outbreak investigation, and we briefly cover different special situation, daycare outbreak, healthcare setting outbreaks. We keep it updated with CDC, ACIP, and I mean key research articles that are out there. It's drafted in conjunction with our local health departments, so every change is blessed by the local health departments. And we're quite happy with our guideline. So why we don't follow the CDC guideline? I would like to take a couple of minutes and go over the rationale why we changed the guideline and how did we come up with these focus guidelines that we have right now. In 2004, we had lots of pertussis in Oregon. We had huge school-based outbreaks, and you know, middle and high school outbreaks are very disruptive to public health resources, to the community in general, and healthcare providers, and so on. And contact tracing and facilitating antibiotics at the time was a large burden for the local health department. And despite our aggressive chemoprophylaxis, cases and clusters continued to occur, and these outbreaks were extended over several months. So in January 2005, state and local health department got together to discuss this pertussis boom in Oregon. Over 1,000 cases were reported, and we have very strict definition. I mean, we go with our own definition that is kind of stricter than CSD definition. And estimated underreporting in pertussis, we know by 10 to 100 fold. So actually, there is more pertussis out there that doesn't come to our attention. These prolonged outbreaks, one of our outbreaks went over 9 months. Questionable effect of prophylaxis. One unfortunate student was prophylaxed 4 times during one outbreak. Diversion of public health resources that burden to the local health department. Our efforts to promote judicious use to antibiotics, and the most importantly that we found out, it was the shaky scientific support what we're doing. So we did a literature review on the key articles that were out there, and we have that on our website, and we concluded that household erythromycin prophylaxis is not an effective public health tool. I mean, whether the rapid and sensitive PCR and Tdap and more tolerable antibiotics such as erythromycin will change the picture, will increase the efficacy of prophylaxis, that's not known. So based on our experience, our finding, we talk with pertussis expert at CDC, we talk with Canadian, Australian. I mean, we did review other guidelines that have revised their approach on pertussis out there. We decided to shift from this guideline and adopt an international approach to pertussis. When you change the approach, you have to make sure that you change your goal. I mean, we stopped pretending that we're going to control pertussis in the community because for the above reasons, we don't think that's feasible. And we can't control pertussis through prophylaxing everybody. So our new goal was trying to protect severe morbidity and mortality while we minimize the use of antibiotics. And to do this well, we sharply limit prophylaxis to vulnerable close contacts.
And I think that what you, Ventila, is bringing up is an important point. And right now, what we'll do is we'll hold off that discussion until later. What I'd like to do right now is just to, again, focus on the guidelines. You know, those who are at the local level, has this been helpful, or what is the format that you would think with regard to the information and how it's presented, what would be helpful to you? And I'd how many people are familiar with this with these guidelines or have used them in the past? And how many people have found it helpful? And why? I mean, I'd love to hear your opinions as well. Why do you think, what has been helpful to you?
Hi, I'm Jolie Stone from Oklahoma, and we have a centralized system at the state office, so we oversee all our counties with pertussis investigation. We're one of the fortunate ones, I guess. But we, like Oregon, have designed our own outbreak control guidelines. We have what's called an epidemiologic manual that's given to all our counties. And in it, it has a very Cliff Notes version of how to do an outbreak investigation. But if we have not really had any true outbreaks of pertussis. We have a lot of sporadic and single cases, and maybe it goes through a family, but not really an outbreak. So to be honest with you, in the past 5 years, I haven't opened that up but once.
And I think that's helpful. I mean, the fact that it's a Cliff Notes version, so the fact that you just need specific information and not necessarily a lot of the background.
Yeah, and what we also have in our Cliff Notes version is we do have information for physicians and providers that is an easy document that you can fax that includes prophylaxis recommendations, what's considered a close contact, and we do follow the Red Book and the ACIP and the Control of Communicable Diseases Manual for consideration of what's considered a close contact and for prophylaxis recommendations.
Thank you, that was very helpful. Yeah, please get some candy. We need to maintain or raise the energy level. Is there anybody else who would please like to share their thoughts about the current guidelines? What their likes, their dislikes? Yes, is it easy to use with regards to their 11 chapters? I mean, in very specific, you know, on school setting, on community outbreaks, on diagnostics, is that helpful in at the local level, or do you need something that's a little bit more Cliff Notes-like? I see nods of heads, but I would love to hear voices. Thank you.
Well, this is from our epidemiologist. I just texted her, and she said that she would like to see... what constitutes a close contact, who should be prophylaxed. Mm-hmm. So more guidance on how to handle contacts. That's her big sort of concern about this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you. You know, Jennifer, I just wanted to add, I think that it's helpful to have, at least for me, it's been helpful to have the different sections because I can just pull out eight. We all know eight, right? It's the school. School. So that's been helpful for me. But it does, we do need to think about vaccination, who are the close contacts, and I think we're going to try to get to that today.
Great.
Well, and then other measures, too, because I think we want to talk about what else we might do. For instance, in one of our outbreaks, we excluded kids with cough illness until they'd been seen by a doctor. Mm-hmm. So
I would just say it's helpful to have everything in one source, rather than looking here and looking there and putting it together, because we've used that as well as some other sources to put together our own sort of local or statewide system. But there's a lot of information in there, and I don't have to be searching all over the place. So in that regard, it's helpful for us at the state level anyway to get started and to help the locals, you know, and to direct them as to which way to go, and we can always go back to that.
Okay, great. What I'm going to do is just with that last comment, format of the new guidelines. This is kind of some thoughts that we've had behind it. You know, do we want a fixed menu versus an a la carte? What is helpful in the type of format? You know, a la carte regarding options, you know, a set of options of prevention and control measures that can be provided and be different depending on the setting or scenario. For example, for Chapter 8, the school setting, you know, what are the different options that are there? You know, for example, if you have several cases that are reported in several grades, you know, what are the different options with regards to prevention and control? Do you A, prophylax the whole, this is like a choose your own adventure or a quiz. A, prophylax the whole school. B, prophylax just the affected grades. C, target prophylaxis of those students, close contacts, and I say that in quotes, and those who sit next to or near front back, and then put in place a cough exclusion. You know, is that gonna be helpful? The pros to that is that it's empowering. There's flexibility, as similar to what Juventil was talking about with Oregon. There's flexibility in the guidelines and in the control measures and can be customized to the situation because we know that with outbreaks, nothing is ever the same. The cons is that it may require more data for decision making. How do we determine which choice do we make? We need more data. And then inconsistency of response. People are going to wonder, well, why in this school you did this and why in that school you did that. I think that's a consideration to be made with the a la carte options. The second format type would be a fixed menu or a set algorithm. The pros are there's clear guidance, there's consistency in the approach. But then the cons are there's their lack of flexibility, and we know that one size doesn't fit all. What do you guys think of this?
Jennifer, we tried that approach with the algorithms, and you're absolutely right. It lacks the flexibility. Initially, local health departments thought it was great, but then you get into the unusual circumstances, and it does not allow the flexibility and the critical thinking on their end to be able to maneuver around that. So I think we need a mix of it. I like the guidelines. We do develop our own in terms of putting on our website. We reference back to your guidelines, but we have our own guidelines in terms of for the physicians, for case management, for testing, treating. And so I think that, we have to have a combination of the two.
I would agree. Karen Martin from Minnesota. I think that if you want something that's going to be fairly consistent across the states, it definitely has to be flexible, because I feel like even within our guidelines that we have, we do change it based on the situation, and it's always going to be complicated, and I don't know that you can necessarily take that away. That said, you can have cliff notes, so to speak, of initial case in a school, initial adult case, something like that. But ultimately, I think if it's less flexible, then everyone's just going to take it and adopt it to their own manuals, which it sounds like most states have done already.
I just wanted to add that I think that we need to have flexibility, but it's also good to have a national kind of set guidance, and that if there's an unusual circumstance, you can explain why you're not doing that. But Jennifer knows that we've had parents in Illinois who are very savvy and who go on the internet, and then they say to us, well, in Oregon they're doing this, or in this state they're doing this, and then why are you doing this? And it seems like there's no uniformity in public health. Everyone's in sort of a free-for-all, do whatever you feel like. So we've been really criticized by a number of parents, and they even called CDC to complain about that. So I think that it would be good to have some uniformity across the country, and then for special circumstances we can always recognize we might do something different.
We do have a flexible guideline in Oregon, but the principles are the same pretty much. If we get pertussis outbreak in middle school, counties know the principle: active surveillance, case finding, early treatment of cases, prophylaxis, increasing awareness in the community. We have added TDAP in school clinics, but they have the flexibility how to organize the TDAP school clinics. I don't know their county as much as they know. They can come up with the ideas how to get the consent forms, what's the best way to deliver the message in the community, but the principles are really strict for every kind of outbreak in all the kind of settings.
Okay, thank you. Now, I'd like to see, are there any local public health nurses in the audience? I'd love to hear from them and their opinions, because, is there someone in the back who'd like to represent any local public health nurses who, I think, the situation from the federal level and the state level can be different, and I think it'd be really, woo! We'd love to hear from you as well. And please take some candy.
I'm Barb Baker from South Bend, Indiana, and I'm the Director of Nursing at the County Health Department. I think that for us, we've had quite a bit of pertussis, particularly amongst the Amish. And I think it sometimes becomes confusing in how much testing you should do when you have a suspect case, whether you just go ahead and treat prophylactically and not worry about the testing. And I know there are some people who will advocate going ahead and testing, having healthcare professionals do the testing, and then wait for the results before seeing a physician. And I feel very strongly that that is not the way to do it. And so we have not done that at our health department. And I think that the state supports us in that reasoning that someone, if they're that ill or you suspect pertussis, they need to be evaluated by a physician, and you coordinate those types of things. But I think the guidelines from the CDC are what we follow, and I think that for us that seems to be kind of, that is this kind of that is the core guideline. There's always going to be things that fall outside of it, and then you work with the state to say what's the best thing to do in this situation, and it takes a teamwork approach.
Thank you.
I'm Penny, and I work at the Kalamazoo County in Michigan. And our problem, we had some in our private or public schools at one of our larger public schools. And our problem was wondering who to prophylax. We had it in our middle school, where these kids changed different classrooms. We didn't really want to go across the board and treat everybody with Zithromax. So then we were wondering, do we treat them right around the circle that they sit at? Our medical director made the decision to just not do that and to have everybody that was in close contact seek care at their primary physician. And the outbreak kept going and going. It started in beginning of October, and we were still seeing cases in February in this particular school district. At first, we were letting the waivered kids, they had to withdraw from school for the time period, but then he also put a caveat in there where they could just be treated with the prophylaxis for 5 days, stay out of school, then come back. Well, they weren't really protected after that, you know, whatever Zithromax is good for, the 10 days or whatever. So then I think some of that was helping pass on the pertussis. So then we were kind of coming back to, well, maybe we do need to go out and treat all these kids in their direct circle. So it would be great if we had better guidelines on who the direct contacts were and what to do with those kids.
And then just a follow-up question. With regards to having more guidance, will it be helpful as well to have the rationale behind if there is, you know, with the data or with subject matter, like to be able to differentiate, we recommend this or this is the guidance provided because this is based on data or versus this is based on subject, you know, on expert opinion?
I think that'd be very helpful to have more of that. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Lori Parsons, Polk County Health Department Nursing Manager in Des Moines, Iowa. We agree as well with Kalamazoo that the decisions on who we prophylax seems very subjective. There's no, you know, while there are guidelines, it's really just us determining who we felt was within the closest of contacts. Is there any thought, and I noticed from the notes that you'd given us that there are some states who are in the mandate of the vaccination. Is there something that we can do to more proactively get the mandate going for the Tdap vaccination within that junior high school age, whatever we want to make it determined that that's something that we need to do?
Jennifer, to address the first speaker with the special populations, and then I'll touch on the Tdap with the mandate. In Wisconsin, we have about 27 counties with communities with Amish and Mennonite, and one of the things that we found with the Amish population is that testing usually isn't a good option, that they are somewhat reluctant to have the test done, but they are very willing, especially if we've identified a case of pertussis in the community, to treat and isolate especially close household members. So I think special populations do present issues within each of the communities, and they do vary. And at least with the Amish population, we're doing a study right now in working with the Amish and looking at immunization rates in light of some HIB cases, that the immunization rates vary dramatically from the communities, and some parents are bringing their young children in for DTAP, but most are not. In terms of the mandate for Tdap, our law was changed last year for the beginning of the 08-09 school year, and we implemented for the school requirement Tdap to be given at 6th grade, 9th grade, and 12th grade. Some of this was driven by the fact that obviously the vaccine is available, but in the outbreak of 2004, the second highest incident by age group was the 10 to 14 year olds. So we really had some data to support why we wanted to do that. We were fortunate to have the funding to be able to do three grades at a time because we wanted to minimize the impact on the school. We also added another vaccine, which varicella, the second dose. So the schools aren't real happy with us because they're at different grades. But our hope is that within three school years that we would have grades 6 through 12 covered with Tdap.
Thank you, Jerry. I would like to move on to the next section of the talk. Did you have a comment?
I have a question. Now, I have to say I'm not familiar with the recommendations for it, so I have a question more than anything. When we're talking about excluding children that are not immunized, are there specific recommendations about when an outbreak is over or how many days because of incubation periods? I really would like to see states and CDC be hard on those children and the parents, because I do not think it's acceptable. I really believe it's not education, you know, that the parents are uneducated about immunizations when they call themselves excluding a child for religious reasons. There's really only one religion that I know of that would, you know, speak to that. I think people are, they go under the religious exclusion because they have a feeling about, or they've read something about, and so it would be wonderful if, based on incubation periods and outbreak and how many children, that those children, you could give a specific guideline as to how long they could exclude them, because, as you know, the other consideration is that after children are out of school for a certain time, right, they're considered truant, and they're in danger of failing, right, in that particular, right, grade. And so, no, we don't want that, but I do want to lean on those parents and say, get educated and figure out why we're excluding your child. We don't want them to be sick, we don't want them to make other children ill, and we don't want to add to whatever we have going on.
Well,
yeah. Unvaccinated.
Well, we had a very large, and actually it was an MMWR article, outbreak in a high school back in 2006, and we struggled with those same issues. The incubation period for pertussis is 3 weeks, so consider an outbreak over after two incubation periods, so that's 6 weeks. And we did talk about, we excluded kids from the school with cough illness until they'd been seen by their doctor. And I will say that 90% of the PCRs that were done, because this was during the winter time, were negative. So there was, at first, a lot of fear at the school because they thought everyone had it. But then when we found out that 90% of the tests being done at the state were negative, you know, there was a lot less fear. But we couldn't really exclude the kids who hadn't been vaccinated because there is no mandate in our school for Tdap. And it's not life-threatening to that age group. You know, I mean, we know that it will cause problems in infants, but it's very hard to say, well, you know, you might at some point come into contact with an infant, et cetera. So we did not, except for, expecting the school to identify kids with cough illness and have them see their doctor for an evaluation before they could come back to school, and we required them to have a signed note from the doctor, we didn't exclude kids who hadn't been vaccinated.
I was just going to add that I think for pertussis, exclusion of children who are unvaccinated is problematic. It's unlike varicella and perhaps some other diseases, because even if you're fully vaccinated at kindergarten, you know, you're going to have waning immunity. And if you don't have, you know, Tdap mandate in middle school, I mean, you're going to have, even a fully vaccinated child may be susceptible again.
Right.
So to my knowledge, I don't think there's ever been a CDC recommendation for exclusion of unvaccinated children for pertussis.
No, there hasn't been. No.
And the other problem is, if you do exclude for not having vaccine, what's the impetus to get vaccinated? Because there's no data to support that by being vaccinated, you can let them back in. And so, unlike you said, varicella and measles, where if they receive vaccine within 72 hours, you can let them back into school because they're protected, with pertussis, you don't have that.
So, thank you for your comments. What I'd like to do is to move on to the next topic, but if you have any additional comments with regards to the guidelines, the format, anything that any of the topics that have been brought up, please write them down on the form so that we have them, so we can refer to them afterwards. Okay, so the second topic, the core principles, are we looking at a paradigm shift? Chemoprophylaxis, a lot of you have already brought this up, so let's address this. What should be the overarching goals of chemoprophylaxis guidelines? Is it to stop transmission and prevent all cases? And is this even possible? Or, as what you and Tito was talking about with regards to Oregon, focusing on protecting the high-risk individuals, including infants less than 1 year of age. You know, and I think as we have this discussion, I think at the same time, with regards to chemoprophylaxis, we have to reevaluate chemoprophylaxis in the era of Tdap. As we have increased vaccine coverage with Tdap, how is that gonna make an impact on how we chemoprophylax? So does anybody like to, or even Teal, if you'd like to comment?
So first we changed the goal. Our new goal with the new prophylaxis guideline was to suppress the paroxysm of antibiotics while we focus our intervention to those that suffer severe morbidity and mortality. And with the new guideline, after we implemented in May 2005, so right 1 year later, we decided to review what we did because we had three main questions. Is the new guideline affecting pertussis rates in Oregon? Are counties identifying high-risk population? Are they getting prophylaxis in a timeline fashion? And are we seeing more secondary cases? Because it was a scary thing shifting from prophylaxing everybody, whole classrooms, whole households, over and over during an outbreak, and shifting to a new direction, not prophylaxing anybody, but education of low-risk contacts. So it was really uncomfortable, so we did review and we found out that pertussis dropped in Oregon while we use the new guideline. Counties are still identifying the same number of contacts per case, so median was pretty much the same. The review showed a significant drop on prophylaxis and also a significant increase on high-risk people identified by the local health departments, because it's a very strong message in the guideline. We did lots of work to increase the awareness around pertussis and these vulnerable close contacts. And the bottom line is a focus guideline, so that was expected. The other question was, are we seeing more secondary cases because we're avoiding prophylaxis? What we found out was that all the secondary cases had the onset before the investigation of the primary case began. So as we know, only a minority of pertussis come to our attention. Even when they come to our attention in the usual setting of delayed presentation, delayed diagnosis, delayed laboratory testing, imperfect compliance, household prophylaxis is not the greatest public health tool. I mean, in an ideal world, optimal circumstances, it's a beautiful thing. You decrease infectivity. But in the real world, and it's not possible. We also surveyed the local health department, asking them how they feel about the guideline. Was easy? Do they understand it? Do they have barriers? How was the implementation? And the vast majority, 94%, said that it's a self-explanatory guideline. They like it. They spend less time on case investigation because they still have to identify the low-risk people and educate them, but they don't need to keep track of with all of them and follow with prophylaxis and find a way for them to get prophylaxis and make sure that they convince they have to receive prophylaxis and so on. And the main barrier at that time was lack of insurance and the time spent for low-risk people, and also the uneasy feeling there we avoiding prophylaxis because the shift was pretty huge. So
I just have a quick question. Do you consider a high-risk individual to be one that's at greatest risk of developing severe disease, or
correct,
one that has the potential to pass it to a person that could get severe disease?
So we limit prophylaxis to vulnerable close contacts who are infants, pregnant women in the third trimester, since they will have contact with a baby, mm-hmm, household contact of a case if there is a baby or a pregnant woman in the third trimester in that household, or daycare, childcare, including the same.
Okay,
because they will suffer the severe consequences. They
right,
will suffer severe morbidity and mortality.
We do. We also had questions in our case investigations, if you have you may not have a high-risk individual in the household. However, you have someone that may be a healthcare worker that does work with high-risk individuals.
Healthcare workers is another issue. We do recommend prophylaxis for all the healthcare workers, despite the contact with a baby or a pregnant woman. We do recommend prophylaxis.
So would you recommend it for the whole household if there was that type of person?
Oh, no, I'm talking in healthcare setting. In healthcare,
I'm talking about, say, you have a...
No, household, no.
So you wouldn't recommend it if you have a household member of a case who may be a pediatric nurse?
No. But we still have left something on the discretion of local health department. They can go further if they see it's reasonable to prophylax, let's say, unimmunized pediatric healthcare workers or other situation that think that it's reasonable to go further, they can go ahead. But in healthcare setting, pretty much we go prophylaxing everybody who was exposed to pertussis. In household, no, usually.
I'm Chaz DeBull from Washington State, and I'm shorter than the last person who asked this question. We in Washington State have done kind of a hybrid. We recommend high risk only plus households, and that has been a lot easier for our health jurisdictions to deal with, because they just could hardly stand the idea that they weren't going to give prophylaxis to a household. And I know that there is a, you know, we have evidence that it may not be that effective, but on the other hand, there are some papers from the 80s that would indicate that the attack rate in the household of a culture-confirmed case is about 80%. And so, based on that, we recommend prophylaxis of all household members plus high risk, and then we always look at high risk as being either people who themselves can become ill or who have the high potential to transmit to a high-risk person. And that has seemed to be more acceptable to our local health jurisdictions than the more restrictive guideline for high-risk only.
Do you think that would change?
We don't consider immunization status in the prophylaxis recommendations. And that's because you can get some degree of symptoms, and we have no idea of knowing how contagious a person is with modified symptoms.
And I see some nods. I mean, my question for the audience specifically is, do you have a different approach to chemoprophylaxis if you know your cases are in a population with high Tdap coverage versus low Tdap coverage? Great, thank you.
Thank you. And I think Chaz brought up an important point. I mean, you know, we're putting up these options and these ideas forward, but, you know, what, as Chaz had brought up, what are you comfortable with? At what level are you comfortable with these options or with these suggestions, these changes or recommendations? So, you know, just to refer to this chemoprophylaxis options, this table, you know, the option is wide chemoprophylaxis, all close contacts, targeted household members and, quote, high risk, and then restricted close contacts of infants and pregnant women. You know, looking at the pros and the cons for the wide chemoprophylaxis of all close contacts, you know, pros, the potential to interrupt transmission quickly. And again, you know, the question was brought up, is that possible? The cons are, as we're all familiar with, it's resource intensive, the overuse of antibiotics, it's difficult to operationalize the close contact definition. We've heard from many of you, like, to get more guidance on how do you define a direct close contact or a close contact. Unknown effectiveness, how effective is, you know, wide distribution of antibiotics, especially with adherence to recommendations? Are all these people completing the course of antibiotics? With regards to targeted and restricted, the pros are it's better able to define and focus your resources for high-risk contacts, avoid overuse of antibiotics, and less resource-intensive. The cons are the risk of continued transmission in new cases. We don't, again, even with this, we don't know the effectiveness, and then again, with antibiotics adherence to recommendations.
So can I just add one thing, Jennifer? We, in 2004, like so many of us, we had many schools. We had 65 schools with cases of pertussis, and in the, you know, middle school and high school years. And we did a survey of parents of contacts at one of the high schools, and we found that for a variety of reasons, only 35% of them actually got the prophylaxis. So, of course, it's a tremendous effort on the part of public health and the schools to try to identify who's sitting around a case in all the different classrooms, et cetera, and notify everything. And then, so I think that we're kind of misleading ourselves if we think that that's really going to make any difference, because if only a third of the people who you recommend prophylaxis to actually get it, because they're not considering themselves high risk. They don't have an infant, they don't have an elderly person, you know, they know because of our messages that they'll have a cough for 100 days, but it's probably not going to be life-threatening, you know. They're not going to get the prophylaxis. They don't have time, you know. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that at least we've done that one small study, and we found there was really not good compliance with the prophylaxis recommendations.
I'm also curious to hear from the local perspective, like how often they're finding that they're having to address, you know, second and third generation of cases. You know, you may have a school-based outbreak, but you might miss the community transmission that's occurring. And I know we've heard from some states and from some local, you know, health offices that, you know, they don't know what to do. They're on the third round of giving antibiotics. What do they do? So if you have any feedback on that, we'd love to hear it. So.
My name is Jessica Golian. I'm the chief epidemiologist with the Denton County Health Department. We had a significant increase in pertussis last year, and we had about 8 different school-based outbreaks. One of the problems that we found was that we would have transmission within the school setting, and then we would have kids who would go off to their swim team, their soccer. Our outbreak actually went into the summer because there were so many summer activities involved. Of all the crazy things, we ended up prophylaxing a swim team because we had 5 confirmed cases on that team, and we felt like, you know, what is the likelihood that they're transmitting it swimming? They're outside, you know, all of the things you would normally expect would be against transmission there, yet we found it was happening, and we didn't have any guidelines for that. So definitely we've had issues of you know, maybe it starts in the school or we identify it in the school, but it's going on in the community, and we've prophylaxed thousands of people and it doesn't seem to make any difference. I would like to add, I would really like for your guidelines to see the difference between what is evidence-based research and what is expert opinion would be helpful. Another thing, not to go back too far, but with your guidelines, it might be helpful for some of us if you created a toolkit as well, where you included, like, you know, sample letters to parents and things like that we could use. Thanks.
Good. And I mean, a question for you, Ventila. Do you, when, so you talk about contact tracing and informing people, do you instruct the local health departments what information should be conveyed about pertussis and signs and symptoms to worry about, that sort of thing, or
yes,
leave it up?
We had an outbreak in a school-based setting in 2007, and we're experiencing another outbreak right now. So whenever we declare there is an outbreak setting, we talk with the local health department. We pretty much update them on the guideline, and they send a letter out to all the providers first, letting them know that it's pertussis in community. You should consider pertussis on differential. This is what local public health authorities recommend in Oregon, and we attach our guideline. All the outbreaks that we have been so far since 2005, when Tdap was licensed, and has been in school settings. So we have recommended, of course, active surveillance, treating cases, no prophylaxis if they don't have contacts with higher risk, and Tdap in school clinics. For the outbreaks that we faced in 2007, they had 2 huge in-school clinics and got vaccinated a lot of people. We have talked with CDC, and we know Tdap is not going to stop the outbreak. It's not going to protect people that are already infected in the immediate ring, but it's going to protect with further transmission and further outbreaks down the road. And if you see the epicurve after the vaccination campaign, outbreak is just over. Might be coincidental, but it will be hard having experimental study and you prove it. So we have another outbreak right now with 4 cases. 2 laboratory confirmed, 2 presumptive. They did all the work, and they're having in-school clinics next week. We usually get a list of names. We ran the names to our alert registry. We get a list with kids that are not up to date with Tdap, and the majority are not, and other vaccines as well, and they go ahead.
And so you'd say encouraging vaccine is an important part of outbreak response, if not mandating vaccine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we feel that we're not going to control pertussis through prophylaxing everybody. We're going to control pertussis in the community, increasing the immunity across the lifespan. And
right.
And I have just back to the prophylaxis question. I think similar experience from Tennessee with very low compliance with erythromycin. I mean, a couple questions for the audience. Maybe show of hands, health departments, people that work in health departments that provide prophylaxis directly versus instruct people to go to their doctors and get prophylaxis. Who provides direct prophylaxis through the health department? And who direct them to their physicians? Yeah, okay. So about half and half. Those that provide directly, do you use erythromycin, azithromycin? Yeah. I mean, I think Thank you. And you raise a great question. Maybe I'll let Jen wrap up this, but I think one of the questions we're coming to is around vaccination as well. So.
Thank you. And again,
I do want to ask the question about the having the history of DTaP or TDAP, say within the last 2 or 3 years. I guess that doesn't make sense to me. I that you would not consider that at all. I mean, I realize we may not have looked at it specifically in research for this question, but we've got efficacy and effectiveness data on these vaccines.
But they're
only— Why aren't we using that? It seems to me that that would be something I'd like to see from some guidelines from you.
The vaccine's only 85% effective, and this year especially, we've seen a lot of outbreaks in elementary school where they've had all their doses early elementary school years in Illinois. So
it's not perfect.
They have very mild illness, and we're now checking with the PCR, so I think we're actually seeing more people have the disease than what we really expected previously.
But I do see that as imperfect, but just like we all know, what would be the maximum way to reduce it in that contact would be to vaccinate everybody. But we've already decided that's not cost effective for whatever groups of reasons. So having some history past 2 weeks of vaccination and within some time period, maybe 3 years, still has a pretty good chance that you can feel comfortable within your classroom of not vaccinating certain people or vaccinating others. It makes it more complicated, I understand, but completely dismissing that just doesn't make sense to me.
I don't want to prolong it, but we're having a huge outbreak right now. We had wrestlers at the state tournament contagious for pertussis, at least 15 people who were confirmed cases, 30,000 attendees. Are they high risk? You know, our recommendation was to put pertussis on the differential diagnosis if you develop a cough within the incubation period. In the school that from which 5 of the positive cases came, we have now got 24 lab confirmed cases. And our local investigator has reported to me that we have a history of Tdap on 11 of those. So what I'm doing now, and just one anecdotal experience to share, is that we had a lab worker who had a Tdap in 2008 who did an unmasked pertussis swab. And she is now a lab confirmed case. So I that's why I want people not to be overconfident in the vaccine. And I think in truth, in rural communities, your high risk, low risk disappears in a big hurry when everyone knows everyone. That's another thing I want to put out, that it's different in an urban setting where people have a proscribed group. As opposed to rural. But I think exclusion of symptomatics is really where you stop outbreaks. I just feel really strongly about that. And allowing people to feel overconfident about a negative PCR, another anecdotal experience, 20 miles away from the town with the 24 positive kids, we have another community that hadn't had cases, and so they didn't put any restrictions on their sports events. They just had a little guy's wrestling tournament. One of the moms was PCR negative prior to the tournament, attended, symptomatic, and lo and behold, the Monday after the weekend of the tournament, her culture grew out. So, you know, I think we have to just be pragmatic about the fact that when you've got an outbreak, it may not be very fun for people, but you need to tell them that you got to stop the socialization of symptomatic people until your outbreak stops. And it'd be great if everybody got immunized, but that's not, I feel strongly that's not what's going to stop the outbreak. It's exclusion of symptomatics.
So we get this question from you guys all the time, too, and I'm interested maybe in your opinions about specifically excluding symptomatic people versus sort of shutting down the sports events or the social events or that kind of stuff. How do you think you're able to exclude them specifically, or do you sort of recommend, you know, we're canceling the wrestling tournament?
I don't know if some of you may have heard my measles talk yesterday, but our health authority lies with the local health officers. This poor guy is struggling with this outbreak, and he shut down all the sports events for the town where he had the 24 cases confirmed. And I don't know the number of EpiLinked yet. I haven't gotten that report from him. The coach for this other event actually called and said, should we not have this? And the decision was made that because there were no cases 20 miles away, it was okay. But I think what you have to keep in mind is if we have about 10% of cases reported, our problem lies in the 90% that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. And so what is a community when you've got a pertussis outbreak?
I want to just follow up on that, because at our high school outbreak, there's quite a few kids who are hoping to get scholarships to college and so forth. And so we did, until we got a handle on what the scope was, or what we thought the scope was, we did tell them they couldn't hold the events, but that was really controversial. So we had ultimately ended up just relying on they were adamant they weren't going to even do it, because we had the school make announcements before every sporting event that they had pertussis and that there were symptoms. I mean, so they really did do a lot of stuff that they thought was maybe over the top to try to make sure, but they were kind of afraid of being identified as the plague school too, you know, and then other high schools were saying, well, we're not going to compete with them because they're all contagious, and, you know, so we got into all that. But I think it's really hard to just blanket cancel everything, especially in high school.
Right. Rita, have you ever shut down any Texas football games?
Thank you. How much time do we have? Okay, so we have about 5 minutes left. It's not going to... I know, it's gone by really quickly. This is probably more of a week-long workshop that we need to request next time. It's been brought up throughout this discussion, and, you know, if there's any additional thoughts with regards to the close contact, you know, how do you define a close contact? You know, the challenge is influenced by the setting. Again, how do you define community in the setting of an outbreak in a school and a hospital? What defines a close contact? Yeah, are there any other thoughts? I mean, we've heard some comments and suggestions, or if anybody else. I mean, if you refer to the handout, I mean, the close contact definition from the states, from the panel members, are similar. You know, there are some nuances and some differences, but again, you know, from your experience working at, you know, at the local health department level, are there any suggestions that you may have? If not, please write them down. there is one.
Someone approaching the mic.
Thank you.
All right, I have a question. I'm trying to work with like emergency rooms to get Tdap in there, and there's some resistance to that, and it's due to financial issues. And the other thing is some of the physicians, instead of If they have somebody that's possibly symptomatic, but they really don't want to go through the rigmarole of reporting it to the health department, so they just give the person a Z-Pak and send them on their way. So how do you work with those physicians that really don't grasp the idea that pertussis is in the area, or if it's, you know, the health department's not putting out a mass fax to say, look out for it? So that's the quandary where I am, is how do I talk to these physicians or the ER nurses about, it's really important if you suspect it, you even think about it, you know, to make sure you do a nasal swab and get a culture and then give them the Z-Pak and have the local health department follow up with them as a possible probable versus them just giving them the Z-Pak, grabbing a check and having them leave.
Right.
Sending them back to school.
I was going to say thank you. We did not plant that question, but it's a great segue to the next slide, which is, I think the goal for communication and education is alternatives. I think, you know, one of the key things is notification of area doctors, blast fax, email, media. You know,
you want to encourage them to identify cases and provide early treatment. I think, you know, working with various states and local health departments on outbreaks, I think one of the frustrations has been is to be able to communicate with the physician and have them understand that in, you know, the public health is putting out a notification that there have been cases of pertussis in the community. Please be aware, be advised to add that to the differential and the appropriate measures to take in terms of reporting and chemoprophylaxis or treatment. I think in addition, you know, working with the local health departments is communication to close contacts in the larger community, you know, educated to monitor for signs and symptoms of pertussis. And I know that you and Tila had said with Oregon that the local health department works very closely to do that. You know, yes, please.
Sorry. We have, we use sometimes our health alert network to provide information to local physicians and ERs, especially in certain areas where they may have an increase. We also have a very close relationship with our infection preventionists or infection control nurses at each hospital. And working through them, they do a really good job of providing education to their ER physicians about testing and treating and when to report. So they are a great, great resource if your local or state health departments need a resource to the hospital, your infection preventionists are going to be very helpful.
When you said the ER, are you talking about getting the ER staff vaccinated? Because we had a large hospital outbreak that started, the portal of entry was the emergency department, and then ultimately we had a hospitalist, pediatric hospitalist who did high-risk births and attended, you know, so we ended up having to give prophylaxis to 20 pregnant women and 9 high-risk infants. For the gentleman in the gray shirt, were you talking about getting the staff or just
patients?
Oh, for wound management. Ah, okay. Yeah, because we didn't even touch on trying to get all the adults vaccinated.
I will say we are working a little bit with the Association of Emergency Physicians who are taking up that problem, and so are going to start working with their professional organization to encourage Tdap use in ERs and stuff.
Thank you. One last comment?
Yeah, I'm not a surveillance person. I'm not a public health person. I teach in a pharmacy school that had the great distinction of having a pertussis outbreak in one of our pharmacy classes. And and I teach immunizations, and so it was a humbling experience. And it was right when we were instituting a mandate. It happened right at that time. And one of the things I was really struck by, and I think we had students fairly sensitized to immunization issues, is how many people told me that in interviews that they had with public health people, nobody told them to get vaccinated. And we're at an immunization conference. And to me, it is whatever the issues are about whether vaccine helps an outbreak, that's what keeps rates down, ultimately. And I just think there has to be a very clear, unequivocal message to everybody. Whatever you do about prophylaxis, you gotta get vaccinated. And I just hated to see good public health people, I know them well, but why wasn't this message? And I think they have to hear it repeatedly. Maybe some of them got the message and didn't hear it, but I just think that is such an important message, that you have to be vaccinated. Zithromax, I'm a pharmacist, it only works for 5 to 10 days, then you have no more protection. Right. So yep. I just think that's such a key issue.
We're bobbing our heads.
Great, thank you. And you know, before we close the session, I'd like to acknowledge those who helped design this session as well as our panel members. I'd like to please give them a round of applause, as well as all of you.